high culture meets high technology at the bleeding edge of the radical right. Majority Rights Radio.
Constantine von Hofmeister, hail and welcome to Majority Rights Radio.
Hail, how are you?
I'm fine this morning for me, afternoon for you in Moscow, and it's quite cold there, I understand.
Well, it's not that cold anymore. I think the weather's getting better. Spring is coming. When one walks around the streets, one can already hear the birds singing. It's only -3 degrees Celsius today, as opposed to -30 last week.
Well, that's certainly good to hear. It's nice to know that we can still trust the procession of the equinoxes and the return of the seasons.
Right.
I should mention that it is my practice to present questions from Majority Rights, where I have posted, you know, a request for questions for a guest who is to appear. But we were unable to get many useful questions out of your comment thread, because mostly people only, well, they weren't in the form of questions. Mostly they simply called you wicked and insulted you.
Right.
As far as I know, you may be wicked.
Yeah,
perhaps it's better not to approach it through others' comments, but just to get directly into our discussion.
Okay. I'm ready.
All right. Could we say a little bit about the JQ and then not so much through the majority of the interview?
All right.
That is to say, your position on the Jewish question seems to be nuanced in such a way as to offend everybody.
I'm not sure what you mean. Could you please elaborate on that?
Well, some people appear to hate you because you're an anti-Semite, which is understandable. And other people seem to hate you because you're insufficiently anti-Semitic. Are you both or neither?
I think I'm both. Well, I wouldn't really call myself an anti-Semite. I think that's going a little bit too far, but I would certainly acknowledge the negative influence that certain Jewish groups had in the West so far. But on the other hand, I support the Zionist movement, and I support Israel as opposed to the Islamic threat which is facing Europe.
You not only support Israel, you have publicly supported the most extreme nationalists in Israel, that is, the ones that call for Eretz Israel, Greater Israel, between the two rivers.
Yes, Nile and Euphrates, I support it.
Yeah, that's pretty extreme.
Yes, you think so?
Yeah, so now, moving on from the Jewish question.
Okay.
I don't know anything about your early life. I know that you came to the United States for many years and you lived in New Orleans for 7 years, but I have no idea how it is that you came to move to the U.S. when you were 20. Did you come here for college?
Well, actually, I moved to the U.S. when I was 16. I first was an exchange student in Flagstaff, Arizona. I went to high school there, 11th grade, near the Grand Canyon, and then I stayed there for 2 years.
Did you ever go through Zion National Park?
Nope, never did.
Oh, that's great. That's also near there.
Is that in Arizona?
Yeah, I know.
Arizona?
Zion's on the border between Arizona and Utah.
No, I lived with a Mormon family, actually, which was quite interesting.
Really?
Because my host family were Mormons, so I lived with a Mormon family for a year.
Were they regular Mormons, or were they a polygamous cult?
No, there are no real polygamous Mormons, because the official stance of the official Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is that polygamy is not allowed anymore. So the only polygamous Mormons you have are from radical splinter groups which are not acknowledged by the official Mormon Church. And to answer your question, I lived with a regular Mormon family that were not polygamous, but they still had many children, which is quite common with Mormons.
Presumably the polygamist Mormons would be less likely to host an international exchange high school student.
Yeah, I wouldn't know about that, but they were very happy to host me. As a matter of fact, the father of the family that I stayed with was stationed as a soldier in Germany for many, many years, so he spoke fairly good German, and he liked to visit Germany with me. And in general, they were very good people, very friendly, and I actually learned a lot from them. And I went to Sunday school every Sunday with their children, and I learned about the history of the Mormon Church. And I actually wrote an essay for my high school history class about the history of the Mormon Church after I interviewed several of the ministers of the church there. And I even went to a Mormon wedding in Salt Lake City. But I wasn't actually allowed to witness the actual ceremony since I'm not Mormon, so I had to wait in the wedding room and learn more about the history.
Did you ever wear the special Mormon underwear?
No, I didn't notice such a thing.
Ah. Yes, they have to. They wear a temple garment next to the body.
I think I've heard of it. I probably forgot about it. Anyway, it's like similar to Sikhs, I guess. The Sikhs in India have to wear special underwear as well.
That
restrains the sexual urge. Yes,
It occurs to me that there is actually something that the Mormons have in common with the National Futurists. In Mormonism, there is this idea about the way a man lives his life and his religion leading to personal power in the indefinite future. So I'm saying there's something in common with the idea that by worshiping as a Mormon correctly in this life, having a wife and many children, that I will then be given a planet of my own in the future with dominion over my earthly spawn, now in a spiritual afterlife.
Yes.
But there's something in common between that and the dream of national futurism, which is materialist, futurist.
Absolutely, I absolutely agree with you. But of course, there's a crucial difference, because national futurists don't believe in the afterlife. They believe in genetic inheritance, which the Mormons also believe in, otherwise they wouldn't have so many children. But they believe they're going to have a planet of their own in the afterlife. But I want to have planets of our own, of our race, in the distant future, in this life, in this existence, in the earthly existence.
Right. Because
Yes. Nothing
lives forever, isn't that correct?
Well, the race can live forever, I think. Because the race cannot
can live indefinitely.
Indefinitely. Maybe not forever, but indefinitely. You know, I wouldn't go that far, but yeah, possibly. And yeah, but I think the Mormons also have. I think the Mormons in general are very racially aware, more so than other religious groups in America. They're very outspoken against miscegenation, for example, all the Mormons that I've met, and they definitely discourage that practice, and they procreate a lot within their own race, and which is definitely a fact, you know, and they uphold traditional, I would almost say conservative, pre-1950s American values, which have now been lost in the general populace.
Then you went back to, you went back to Germany to finish 12th grade.
Yes, I went to an American school. I went to the American school in Berlin, which was at that time affiliated with the American military presence in Berlin, the American occupation. So I went to the American school with a bunch of kids of American soldiers and children of diplomats and everything. It was interesting.
You went there only after you came back from the States, or had you been going there all along?
No, never. I just went to regular German schools. It's a complicated story why I went to the American school. Because I failed 10th grade German school and 11th grade.
Such a coincidence. I myself was expelled and thrown out of 10th grade and never finished it.
So was I. I was actually expelled from my German school, and the principal of the German school literally threw the report card in my face and screamed at me and was fuming, saying that in his whole entire career, he never had a student as bad as me. Yes, I was very proud of that, actually.
Oh, it was academic?
It was academic,
there was
behavior and participation. No.
I mean, for instance...
Well, it was behavior as well, because in Germany you get grades in school for general behavior during class, and I actually got an F in behavior.
Was there any fighting? I mean...
Oh, not fighting, just being rude to the teachers, and not in general, just not giving a shit.
Interesting.
Yes, because I was very disillusioned, you know, because I felt that the German school system was restricting my creativity.
It doesn't seem to have done a very good job, does it?
Well, they haven't. That's because I went to America to school, and in America is the exact opposite. I think and the American high school system, no matter how bad it really is, you know, because it's really designed for the very lowest common denominator. But I was one of the 10th best So I was one of the 10 best students in the entire high school in Flagstaff, Arizona. I had like 6 A's, 6 classes, 6 A's, everything. I was on honor roll and all that. And in Berlin, too, at the American High School. And it's interesting. Let me mention this fact real quick, okay? Because in 1994 in Berlin, all the Allied troops, the British, the French, the Americans, and the Russians, they left Berlin. You know, that they stopped their occupation of Berlin in 1994, which was also the year when I graduated from the Berlin American High School. So the school pretty much closed down. But it was sort of an historical American high school because it was the only American high school which ever existed behind the Iron Curtain, because it was in Berlin, and as well,
it
not
was
West
in Berlin.
Was in no, it was in West Berlin.
Oh,
but
you're
Berlin
still
was
saying...
A,
right,
West Berlin was an island in
right.
Germany. So technically, it was the only American school that ever existed behind the Iron Curtain. But it was the last year of that school that had existed for over almost 50 years, ever since the end of World War II, when the Americans started occupying Berlin, till 1994. And interestingly enough, the same week when I had my graduation ceremony, Bill Clinton, the then American president, was in Berlin on a state visit, and he actually planned to come to the graduation ceremony to hand out the diplomas, because it was an historical American school, but he couldn't make it because he had to meet all kinds of German politicians. So actually he sent his wife instead, Hillary Clinton. So I have this great picture of Hillary Clinton handing the diploma to me.
Oh, really?
Yes, really.
You know, I wonder if you can send us a link to somewhere that is on the web, because I think our...
Well, it's not on the web, but I can send you the picture itself.
Yeah,
and
okay. I think that our listeners would probably be fascinated to see that.
Yeah, well, it's true. Anyway, so that's that. And then, because I only had a high school diploma, American high school diploma, it's not good enough for German universities, because they don't accept it. You have to do like an extra year of schooling if you only have an American high school diploma to be able to study in a university in Germany. So I went straight to America to study instead.
But you went to
New
Hampshire.
Sorry?
You went to New Orleans.
No, I went to New Hampshire first for a year. Keene State College, New Hampshire. Not very far from Boston.
Keene State?
Keene State College. Keene State, right.
Spell it.
K-E-E-N-E.
It's obscure. I've never heard of it.
Well, it's quite famous from people who are from New England. Like, I met many people from New England in my life so far, and every time, even if I meet people from Boston, like, in my travels, and I mention Keene State College, everybody knows it. They actually filmed the movie Jumanji with Robin Williams in Keene, the town Keene, while I was there. So I recognize all the buildings in the movie. And I'm actually an extra in the movie. You can see me in one scene because a lot of students were extras in the movie.
That's fascinating. Did you ever get up into Maine? I'm more familiar with Maine.
Well, I've been to Maine a bunch of times. I used to go to Bangor, a good friend there, to hang out.
Maine is wonderful.
The Bangor is a cool city. That a lot of cool bars that I used to go to with live music. And I had a girlfriend who was from Bangor, Maine, so I used to go visit her parents and everything.
So how did you end up in New Orleans?
I left Keene State College after two semesters. I don't know if I want to mention this on the radio program, but what the hell, I'll mention it anyway.
I can edit
it
out.
It doesn't matter. I'll mention it. I'm not ashamed of it, really. So I wasn't evicted. I wasn't kicked out from the college, but almost kicked out. It happened one night. This is where my connection with Russia started. I used to smoke a lot of pot in Keene, you know, and drink a lot of vodka on the weekends and everything. And I had a very good friend who was actually Russian, but he was also a foreign student, but he was studying in Keene as well. And he was a good friend of mine. Actually, he was Armenian, but he was from Moscow. Mikhail Sabujan was his name. He now lives in Philadelphia. He's married to an American chick, I think. Yeah. But anyway, back then we were young, wild, crazy, drugs and booze and everything, you know. Right. So one night, me and him drank like 3 bottles of vodka or something. It was like rip-roaringly drunk, right? Okay. And I lived in a dorm, of course, and there was a communal bathroom, you know, for all the people in the dorm. And he was a great artist. He is a great artist, like a great painter, you know. So we started painting the walls of the communal bathroom with surreal pictures and everything. Because back then I was very much into surrealist art and surrealist poetry and symbolist poetry.
Wait, you were very drunk. What did you paint? Were you using actual paint or?
Yes, actual paint. Oil paint. And right. Acrylic paint, yes. So we painted the communal bathroom, and somebody observed us. We didn't know that somebody was observing us painting the communal bathroom, but that's apparently what happened. And that person that observed us, of course, reported us to the authorities. Piece of shit. Anyway, so we could call to the dean's office, and the dean gave me a big lecture, like, blah, 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 blah. And he pretty much said, yeah, we're not going to kick you out of school, but you're not allowed to live in any dorm for the next, I don't know, 4 semesters or something. But since all my friends lived in the dorms, and that's where all the parties were happening all the time, I decided, yeah, fuck that, I'm going to leave Keene. So I left. And then I went to India for 6 months.
Ah, on the trail of Savitri Devi.
No, at that time I hadn't even heard of Savitri Devi. I just went to India because my parents have connections with India that go back to the early 70s, and there are many friends, and I've been to India ever since I was 10 years old. I went to India on trips with my parents, and I'm sort of pathologically obsessed with Indian culture and the country and the people.
Where did you go? Did you go to Goa, for instance? I mean, when I interviewed Sunik, he said he went to Goa in the 70s.
Right. Well, I went to India then in 1997. For 6 months, I went to Bombay, and I worked for a British language. For an English language weekly Indian newspaper, sort of like a tabloid paper, a weekly English language paper. And I wrote travel articles for them. So I traveled all over India and Bangladesh and Tibet. No, not Tibet, Nepal and various other Asian countries that border on India, and Indian cultural centers, temples, and things like that, and wrote about it from a Westerner's perspective for an Indian readership.
Is that where you met your Bhutanese friend?
No, I met those later. Okay. I went back to India many, many times. I met those at a later time.
Well, this is absolutely unprecedented. Please continue.
So I lived in Bombay for 6 months, traveled all around India, made very good friends with the Parsi community in Bombay. And as we all know, or at least I know, and many other people know, the Parsis are the only true Aryans that are left in India, because they're not real Indians anyway. They are originally from Perth.
Aren't the Parsis also a merchant class that has always kept itself separate, somewhat analogously to the Jews? Doesn't Kevin MacDonald say
that? Exactly. Exactly. You're exactly right. The Parsis are the Jews of India. And I mean that in a positive sense, as a matter of fact. There's only about 100,000 Parsis left in India now, but they originally came to India a couple of hundred years ago when they were because they believed in Zarathustra, the Zoroastrian religion, the fire temples and everything. And they were persecuted by the Muslims in Persia, so they found refuge in India. And ever since then, they've been in India. But all my good friends in Bombay now, and I'm still in regular contact with them. Most of them are Parsis, and a lot of them, if you see them, they're indistinguishable from any Northern European. Even, you know, they could be sitting in a bar in Germany, and nobody would think that they're not German. Yeah, unfortunately, they're dying out because they're now marrying outside the Parsi community. So they're slowly shrinking, unfortunately.
Yes, whither the West? It's a good question. So keep going. So you're working for this paper, and you're in India.
Yes.
We still have to get you back
to
New Orleans.
After my stint in Bombay, I went back to Germany, and maybe not all of your listeners know this, but in Germany, it's mandatory that after the age of 18, you do military service for 10 months.
I am aware of that.
Right. But if you don't want to do military service, you can do social service instead for 13 months, right? And I didn't want to go to the military because it's too much work. It's like getting up at 6 in the morning with strange men that I don't know and probably won't get along with, so I said, enough. Screw that, I'm not going to the military. So I did social service instead. And I lived with my parents again for 13 months in Germany. And I worked in a mental hospital, taking care of mental patients, wiping their ass, showering them, playing games with them, cooking food for them, going on excursions with them, and, yeah, other activities. And yes, after these 13 months, worked in a mental hospital.
And that's when you realized that you wanted to organize your life around helping people.
Yeah, not necessarily retards or mentally deficient people. At that time I was in my artistic phase, because actually those crazy people inspired me a lot to write more poetry.
Hmm.
Yes. So I didn't have my racial awakening then yet.
No, keep going.
All right, okay. So after working at the mental hospital, then I went to New Orleans. The reason why I went to New Orleans, because my Russian comrade, my Russian friend, who I had met in Keene State College before, as you remember I told you,
yeah,
he had already transferred to the University of New Orleans, which is the State University of Louisiana system. And I didn't want to go back to Keene, of course, you know. But I still wanted to continue studying in America, and my parents supported me financially, so I really didn't have to worry about a job or anything, you know. I was pretty much a spoiled brat back then, and I'm not ashamed to say it, because everybody would do it if they had the chance. So I went to the University of New Orleans, and yeah, I pretty much stayed there for almost 7 years in the city, not only studying, but also doing various jobs and various magazines, journals, and newspapers. And in between, I went back to India also for another year to New Delhi. And that's where I met the Bhutanese National Socialists.
So you did get a degree in New Orleans eventually?
Yeah, I did. I got my bachelor's in comparative literature and my master's in political science.
And would you say that in the New Orleans of the late 1990s, early this millennium, that you were pretty well known? I mean, it seems like you were there for a while. You were writing for magazines.
Yeah, but it wasn't like far-right magazines. It was I was fairly well-known. I had like several, like, it's a really happening place, of course. It's like a party town, everybody knows, you know. And I was writing for like the independent music journal. I used to go to a lot of like live rock concerts and write reviews of the bands and everything, you know.
Which is how you came to smoke pot with Rammstein.
Yes, interesting. That's good that you mentioned that. I had many girlfriends, but one of my girlfriends, she was heavy into music, you know, which is not surprising. It's New Orleans. I'm not really that interested in music, but I appreciate good music when I hear it, of course. Even rock music, modern music, you know, I like a lot of it. And yeah, she was actually a lighting technician for rock concerts, and Rammstein gave a concert in New Orleans, and she was responsible for the lighting of the concert. So she did all the lighting of the concert, and of course she met them backstage, because she was working backstage, right? And yeah, she was chatting with them after the concert, and I guess they hit it off, my girlfriend and the Rammstein people, and she invited them to our apartment after the concert, you know, to smoke pot. But I wasn't even aware of that, because I didn't attend the concert. I was out with friends, like boozing it up at some bars or something. So I come home like at 1 or 2 in the morning, and there's all these the whole Rammstein band and my girlfriend sitting in our living room smoking the bong, you know, which was interesting. So of course I joined in and I chatted with them. But yeah, I was quite disappointed, because they didn't strike me as a really intellectual, intelligent type. They were actually, they were behaving like idiots. Maybe because they were too stoned, or maybe they just really are idiots. I don't know.
They're not actually right wing. So I think that one of them actually married a Jewess and then got divorced.
Yeah, I would marry a Jewess immediately, you know. So that doesn't matter to me if they're married to a Jew or not, you know. It doesn't even matter to me if a person is right wing or not, you know. And as long as they have something interesting to say, as long as I can relate to them on some level, you know. I have no fear of associating myself with left wing people, even, and I do, as a matter of fact.
That's great. So what made you leave New Orleans? Did you sense that the flood was coming?
Well, yeah, I wasn't there during the flood, but no, I didn't really sense that. But I don't know, I just finished my degree, and I thought it was time to move on. And I had made many contacts in Moscow and Russia in general while I was still in New Orleans, and I decided to move to Russia to study the Russian language and immerse myself with politics here in Russia.
And by this time, by the time you leave New Orleans, you are in fact a confirmed extremist, whether right or whether neither right nor left, but forward. But
beyond left and right, of course, yes, absolutely.
By this point, you're already a racialist.
Yes, 100%.
And it was New Orleans, and this happened in New Orleans.
Yes, New Orleans turned me into a diehard racialist.
Really?
Yes, possibly because of my personal experience there with the Negro population, because New Orleans is 70% black, as everybody knows. And I would say 99% of my personal experience with Negroes was negative. And it was because they were Negroes and not because they were just bad people, because they're just innately the way they are. You know, I don't want to use any racial slurs or anything, so
thank you, because as you know, at Majority Rights, we like to keep the level of the discussion somewhat elevated.
No, of course, I understand that. That's why I'm not going to. That's
right.
Why I will not go on a rant right now.
Without going on a rant, though, could you describe an incident or two that really changed your mind or that made an impression on you?
Well, I was robbed twice, once at knife point and once at gunpoint. Twice while waiting for a bus in the French Quarter late at night. That wasn't very pleasant, of course.
By an African-American person?
Yeah, I hate that term, African-American, so I refuse to use it because I think it's silly. By a Negro, yes. And I think Negro is an acceptable word, in my opinion. And I always use it, even in America and in polite society. I refuse to say African-American out of principle. Anyway, so, yeah, I was waiting for a bus in the French Quarter to go home after partying at some bars or whatever, you know. And, yeah, a Negro came up. He's like, "Yo, motherfucker, white boy, give me all your money, motherfucker," with a gun, you know. And what am I going to do? Of course, I gave him my wallet immediately. You know, it's better to lose your wallet than your life, you know. So, he took my wallet and left, you know. And the second time, it was actually my fault. Well, I wouldn't say it was my fault, but I was being irresponsible. Because I walked home, because I didn't live far from the French Quarter at that time, but I walked through a very bad Negro neighborhood, ghetto, so to speak, you know, where they like to sit on the couches and train Colt 45 and, you know, hoeing with the bitches and whatever they do. Anyway, and they harassed me while I was walking past, and of course they wanted my money, or just harassing me, and pulled out a knife, and again, same scenario. I just gave them the money I had, and they said, "Yeah, fuck off," whatever. Threw some beer cans after me, and I left. Yeah. But it's interesting, though. I want to mention one thing, if you don't mind, okay?
Yes.
About the Negroes in New Orleans. While they're very aggressive towards whites, is a fact, it's impossible to deny it. I had positive experiences with them as well, though. Like, I was very, very good friends with an older Turkish man with one leg. Like, he was in his 50s, but he had fought, and he wasn't an American citizen, but he had lived in America for 30 years, because he fought as a mercenary in the Vietnam War, as a mercenary hired by the U.S. As a Turkish citizen, you know, to fight, I don't know, to special missions, whatever. Anyway, but he had one leg, but he didn't lose it in the war, that one leg.
What was his
name? Lost it because Oral. I forget his last name, but it was his first name. Yeah, he was some crazy SOB, as they say. Right. Anyway, but he had a lot of black veteran friends, you know, from the war, you know. And I would go out with him quite a few times, actually, and he always invited me to come to all black bars, you know, like where all the Negroes like to be by themselves, you know. And yeah, and I've been to many all black bars in New Orleans, and yeah, never, ever, 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 ever was I harassed there, insulted, or bothered in any way. As a matter of fact, they were really, really polite to me, even though I was the only white guy, the only non-Negro in the entire bar, except the Turkish guy. Like, yeah, they were all very, very, very nice and friendly. I was really surprised by that.
But that good experience wasn't sufficient to make you into a universalist Mondialist
No, but that just confirmed my view that the races need to be separate, because obviously the Negroes have no problem when they're amongst each other, and whites don't have a problem. It's only when the mixing starts, if there's a high percentage of Negroes in an otherwise white bar, when the problem starts, because the Negroes have this inferiority complex or whatever. They think all whites are out to get them, and they have to prove their masculinity, that they will not bow down to the white man, even though the white man doesn't do anything to them, so they start trouble, you know. So, yeah, that just confirmed my view, pretty much.
All right, so that gets you to Moscow. I think I understand your life better now.
Okay, well, good.
Let's move the discussion. Let's talk about Norman Lowell and Imperium Europa, and you have actually an idea very similar to Imperium Europa, and you've thought of a clever name for it.
You mean Europia?
Yes.
Yeah, but Europia is not the name of an imperium or an empire. Europia will be the new name of a city which is now in Moscow, but used to be in Germany, which is now called Kaliningrad, used to be called Königsberg in East Prussia, but I think this city should be renamed in a future Imperium Europa. The city itself should be renamed Europia.
Isn't that the very city that the great philosopher Immanuel Kant lived in?
Exactly. He was born there, he lived there all his life, and he died there. And I myself, for the first time 5 weeks ago, went to Kaliningrad to visit it, and I paid my respects at the tomb of Immanuel Kant in one of the very few German structures which is left in the city, which is an old 14th century Lutheran church.
What country is it in now?
It's in Russia. It's part of the Russian Federation. It's in Russia.
Not Ukraine, not Belarus.
No,
Russia.
No, it's in Russia. But it's Kaliningrad Oblast, and Oblast means district. And the Kaliningrad Oblast, it's a part of the Russian Federation, but it is separated from mainland Russia, because surrounding Kaliningrad Oblast, you have, I think, Lithuania and Poland. So if you want to travel, say, by train from Moscow to Kaliningrad, you have to actually travel through another country, but it's still Russia.
We should mention that Kaliningrad used to be named Königsberg, and it was the site of the famous Seven Bridges of Königsberg, which great mathematician Leonhard Euler used. There was a puzzle based on the Seven Bridges of Königsberg, namely, could you think of a route which took you over each bridge exactly once? And it turns out that you couldn't, and from this he developed what we now know as graph theory.
Well, thank you very much for telling that. I was not aware of that. You learn something new every day.
Well, so Europia, which sounds, I think, like utopia, I think that's the idea.
Yes,
it
is.
Would this necessarily be the capital of Imperium Europa?
Possibly. Not necessarily, but possibly. I think it would be. I think I chose the city Kaliningrad/Königsberg because, for me, it is a symbol of reconciliation after the fratricidal civil war, which is also known as World War II.
Between Germans and Slavs.
The Teutonics and Slavs, Germans and Russians specifically, the two main opponents in World War II. And that city should not be returned to Germany, but it should also not exclusively belong to Russia. Before we say reach the imperium stage, and actually a lot of Russian politicians and German ones are actually seriously considering this option, which I'm going to mention right now, is that Kaliningrad, Königsberg, because it's an important port city, should be an autonomous region, which could be or should be jointly governed by both Germany and Russia. And I think that idea is great. I'm in complete favor of it.
What happens to the current European Union when this happens? Does it dissolve? Does it merge into...
Okay, when what happens, exactly?
In other words, right now we have we have Brussels, which is the capital of the EU, correct?
Right, yes, correct.
How do we get... So is the EU abolished? Does the EU move does Brussels move to Quinnipiac?
No, well, it's not necessary. Like I said, it's not necessary. It's not even ideal. It's just an idea. It's just like sort of a vision. Like
it would be the spiritual capital of the Imperium Europa.
Yes, I think so. I think it should be. No, I wouldn't even say capital. I think it should be one of the most important spiritual centers of a future European empire. And talking about the EU, I think the I'm sort of pro EU as well. You know, I support the EU, but I don't support the EU in its incarnation as it is now. But I support the EU because the EU is already building a sort of pan-European structure. The problem with the EU is it's just not run by pro-European peoples, you know, or by pro-European people. But it's important because they're already building the structure, which is very good. So,
you know, that's
you
a good
have,
line. This is a good line you could use in a, say, in a bar when you want to start a fight with someone. It's like, I support you, but not in your current incarnation.
Right, exactly. Right. Yeah, that's a good idea. Yes, if you get the whole Hindu thing going, right? That's great. Yeah, but that's what I think about. That's what I think about the EU. You know, because it can easily once it's being taken over by the right people, it's perfect. It's a perfect superstructure already for a European empire. A pro European empire, not an anti European anti empire, which the EU is now.
In other words, why should we as radicals mind that there is machinery on the commanding heights now when all that means is that it can be seized?
Exactly. Of course, that's exactly my point. Yeah, I agree.
Now, about the Lowell's idea of Latin as a lingua franca of the Imperium Europa, I believe you might be familiar with my idea that actually Latin is difficult to learn, and we should look for a modern synthetic language, which is pan-European and largely based on Latin, as well as German and English, namely Esperanto. That if we need a lingua franca, Esperanto would, in fact, be much better than Latin.
Well, I'm opposed to both ideas. I'm opposed to both Latin and Esperanto. And as a matter of fact, Latin is not hard to learn. I disagree with that statement because I myself studied Latin for 4 years in Germany, and I read it quite well. It's not very difficult. It's very logical, you know. And they don't have a lot of exceptions. Like, say, Russian. I'm having the hardest time learning Russian because there's so many exceptions. It's extremely difficult and 6 cases and everything, you know. So Latin is actually quite easy to learn, I think. But it's just unrealistic. Like, I think, and I might even sound like a heretic, you know, but I think English should be lingua franca of a future European empire.
Yeah, the disadvantage there is that I already know English, and so it's not a fun idea for me.
Right, but you know Esperanto?
Well, I would if anybody else would adopt it as the language of our movement. I mean, look, when the Zionist state was founded, they went to a new language, Hebrew, which people
But it wasn't a new language. They actually resurrected an ancient language.
Right, it was resurrected. But Esperanto is the most successful example of a constructed language. There are millions of people today. More people speak Esperanto fluently and natively now in this world today than speak Icelandic fluently and natively.
Yeah, but not.
Plus,
not more,
Esperanto was invented as a aid to world peace, universalism, and mondialism. And so I think it would be wonderfully amusing if it were perverted from the viewpoint of the Esperanto peaceniks to our project. And I think it's doable.
So why are you not a pioneer, and why are you not studying Esperanto?
Well, I do a little bit of Esperanto learning. It's difficult because there's no one to
say
practice
with. Say something in Esperanto.
Let's see.
If you can.
Yes.
I hate to put you on the spot like that.
Constantine, tio okazas.
I don't know what that means. Is that
what's happening? Tio okazas. Logos Constantine in Moscow? Yes, Constantine Logos in Moscow. Logos Constantine in an apartamento?
Da.
Yes.
Da, it's a problem.
See, it's easy. Wait. You know, Quo estes tio? Quo estes tio? Tio estes homo. What is that? Mm-hmm. That is a man.
Well, I think I understood that. Okay. You know, okay. I find that idea intriguing, and I will think about it. How about that?
Okay. All right. Do you want to say a few words about... there's nothing definite been announced yet, but there is a conference coming up in Moscow this summer.
Okay, but I...
Can you say anything about that?
Actually, I cannot at this time. That is because I am not part of the organizing committee of the conference, and I have been asked not to reveal anything about it until it's official, and which will be in the coming weeks, and you will be one of the first people to hear about it, and then you can officially announce it on Majority Rights. But until then, I have to unfortunately tell you that you need to wait.
We'll be right back with Constantine. But first, Carl McTaggs, IIV 17.
Thank you.
We now return you to the interview portion of our show, which is already in progress.
There seems to be a consistent attitude of what you call Aryan anti-fascism that runs through your essays, and this is very important to you.
Right, it is. It is.
You're opposed to Hitler worship, for instance.
Yes, I am vehemently opposed to it, because in my opinion, to worship Hitler is to worship a person who was deeply opposed to any kind of pan-European ideology. And therefore, if a white nationalist worships Hitler, he worships a person who's actually against Europe. Therefore, that makes the white nationalist against Europe as well, you know. So, and I stick to my argument that Nazis are essentially anti-European.
Because the invasion of Soviet Russia by Hitler...
Exactly.
In on
June 22nd, 1941, marked the death of Europe. Like
not only the death
Europe,
of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact.
Well, Hitler broke the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, the non-aggression pact, and he purposely broke it. He always wanted to break it. He never took it serious. Stalin took it very serious. Stalin never had any intention of breaking the pact, as opposed to what many so-called historical revisionists now say, that argue that the invasion of the Soviet Union, Operation Barbarossa, was a preemptive strike, because it wasn't. You know, there's no evidence for it, and there's ample evidence against this quote-unquote theory, right? And the so-called crusade against Bolshevism was in reality merely a conquest of Lebensraum, of living space, as Hitler had already outlined in Mein Kampf, you know. So it's not a far stretch to say that Hitler, from the very beginning, even before the NSDAP came into power, had visions or plans to conquer Russian territory and sort of resettle that Russian territory after the expulsion of the native population there with German farmers.
You know, there was a movie from Germany 10 or 15 years ago about Stalingrad. It might have been a TV movie. I actually saw it. Sven, my German friend in the neighborhood, showed it to me. Do you know what I'm talking about? It's about the fall of Stalingrad. But in the beginning, the soldiers are on a train.
Right.
And that
was made for cinema. That was a famous German movie. Yes, I know which one you're talking about.
Yeah, and they look out at the peasants and say, these are going to be our farms.
Yeah, but that's exactly the ideology that the Nazis back then espoused, you know. And if you don't realize that today, as a good European, in Nietzsche's words, then you again falling into the chauvinist trap. Into the National Socialist chauvinist trap.
I think I can sum this up. In other words, you think that just because we reject the voice that says no longer will there be any us versus them. From now on,
right,
is only us.
Everyone
friends
us,
and the creation of the universal object, the absolute object,
right.
By the destruction of all boundaries and the realization of humanity, or perhaps all life, as one undifferentiated whole of suffering individuals. Just because
exactly.
We reject that does not mean that it is not important to be careful where we draw the line between us and them. And in fact, you think it has to be drawn not so that the boundary doesn't... It isn't drawn too narrowly. So you think that drawing a boundary between Teutons and Slavs was a terrible mistake?
No, it was a terrible mistake, and it wasn't. And I think mistake. This is a word that the Nazis even today use. Oh, it was a mistake. Some enlightened Nazis, you know, use that word. Oh, it was a mistake, you know. But it's not a mistake. I think, is a gross understatement. It was a crime, 20 million Russians died in the process, you know. It was not a mistake, it was a crime. Therefore,
So you don't agree with Savitri Devi, for instance?
No, absolutely not. Oh, I agree with her in many, many regards when she writes about Aryan paganism, for example, when she writes about Hinduism, and when she writes about the Muslimification of India, the Islamification of India. I agree with her wholeheartedly, but I do not agree with her Hitler worship, of course.
How about Francis Parker Yockey, who, by the way, came from Chicago?
He was a rabid Slavophobe, and I appreciate a lot of what he wrote, his geopolitical thoughts, but I despise him for his Slavophobia.
Evola.
Therefore, he's not a pan-European role model.
Evola.
I once read Revolt Against Him on a World, but I simply find it boring.
Okay.
Yeah, literally. I actually wrote an essay about that where I don't agree with Ebola's and even Yockey's notion of a spiritual race. That I think that is silly and also counterproductive. And I advocate a crass materialism in terms of race, because a spiritual race or spiritual racialism is not going to save us. Only crass materialism will.
You know, I was thinking that we should adopt the term poetic materialism to mean something or other, as you know, but it turns out that some surrealists in Spain are already using that to mean something else.
Yeah, we'll hijack it and use it for our own ends.
But there's no reason that poetic materialism can't be crass materialism. I mean, there's no reason poetry can't be crass.
Of course, poetry should be crass, in my opinion, you know, because some people might find shocking, offensive, you know, like, I mean, some people might find my writing shocking and or offensive, but in my opinion, that's a good thing because it makes people think, you know. And a lot of people will probably write in the comment section after this interview, they say, oh my God, Konstantin von Hofmeister, he's so arrogant, he thinks that we're offended by his writings. But we're not, you know. But of course they are. Otherwise, they would not even comment at all, you know. It does offend them. And it does maybe even hurt them. It's like, oh, how can he do that? How can he say that, you know?
Well, this will be refreshing, because normally after the interviews, there are many critical comments about me. They say...
You?
Oh, yes. You know, you interrupted too often. You didn't let the gentle soul of the interviewee, you know, sprout forth and produce its unique blossom. And this is what the interviewer should do. It should be like the gentle sun in the rain that evokes the most beautiful growth possible from the seed of the interviewee. And somehow I fail to do that.
Well, I think you've been a good interviewer so far.
What I'm saying is. You're going to draw their fire, you think. You think people will criticize you more than me on this one.
Well, right, but possibly. Especially, you know, like, I have no problems. I work together, like, with National Socialist organizations. I have many National Socialist friends, you know. Don't get me wrong, you know. It's not like I refuse to even collaborate with them. I do on many levels, you know. But I just do not share their chauvinist ideology. A chauvinist in the sense that it is anti-Slav in its essence. I mean, many National Socialists will deny it. They will say, no, we're never anti-Slavs, but yeah, it's all bullshit, you know, and everybody knows it, you know. Thousands and thousands of documents prove the anti-Slavic nature of National Socialism, and it's beyond argument.
Finally, a final word. Could you say just a little bit about how you came to know the great Norman Lowell?
I got to know him through... I discovered his website on the internet just by accident, and I was very intrigued by his ideas, because there are a lot of excerpts from his book on his website, Credo, and yeah, I agree with a lot of what he says. Some things I disagree with, but with the most important parts of his ideology or philosophy, I do agree with. And a good friend of mine, David Stennett, who is American but now lives in Prague. He's very good friends with Norman Lowell, and he has been to Malta and promotes Norman Lowell's cause all the time, and is actually now editing Norman Lowell's book, a new book which is going to come out very soon. And I am going to write an introduction to the book as well.
Will it be out by July?
I'm not sure. Possibly. In the next couple of months, I'm out of my hands. I don't know. Soon. It will be out soon. Yeah. It will be a second book after his first book, Credo. So I think a lot of people are eagerly awaiting the release of Norman Lowell's new book.
Well,
and yeah, I support Norman Lowell's ideas. He's very, very radical, but he's very sane in his ideas. And I think...
radical is one of his five R's, right?
Yes. What is it? The racialist, reactionary, revolutionary,
right.
Radical, yeah.
Right.
Radical, racial, revolutionary, reactionary.
It works no matter what order you say it in.
It does. And yeah, I agree with it. I think it's a very good credo, and I'm on very good terms with Norman Lowell. We exchange a lot of emails, and I'm looking forward to meeting him in Moscow in a couple of months, because he will be one of the speakers at the next conference here.
You know, it was Lowell who introduced, you know, me to you.
Yes, I know that. Yeah, I sent him an email. Yes, I'm very grateful for that.
Although you had previously read something I'd written.
Yes. As a matter of fact, I read your essay on the now defunct National Bolshevik Party USA, one of your essays. And yeah, I found it very fascinating, and I'm very much in agreement with it. And I think you should actually publicize that essay again, and maybe even elaborate on it.
Leviathan will eat itself.
Exactly. I agree. And I pray that it will.
Oh,
to all the gods in the sky.
I don't think there's any doubt that it will. I think we know that.
Yes. And it must. For our race to survive, it is essential. We must praise chaos and destruction. Like I wrote in one of my essays, things must be destroyed, must be utterly annihilated before the phoenix can rise again from the ashes of the destroyed old.
Have you heard of Roger Griffin? Roger Griffin is an academic in Britain who studies post-World War II fascism.
Yes, I read one of his books about fascism a while back. Yes.
Anyway, and the essential core of fascism, he says, is palingenetic, ultranationalist populism. And palingenesis is the rising of the phoenix, the rebirth.
Yeah, exactly. I'm in complete agreement with it.
So I think what you and I are talking about is perhaps not populist, but it's certainly ultranationalist, and it's certainly palingenetic.
Well, and it certainly must be pan-European. That's why now one of my next essays will be about National Bolshevism again, but a new definition of National Bolshevism, because National Bolshevism now is National Socialism for the white race.
Perhaps National Bolshevism will, in the end, come to America in a different form.
Well, I certainly hope so. It wouldn't be a bad thing.
This program owes its very existence to the generous support of Majority Rights and our other contributors. And also, in a very real sense, it owes its existence to you, the listeners, for whom this entire project is being undertaken. Thank you, and good night.